I love starting my videos with airplanes flying overhead. All right, so have you ever caught yourself having one of those unsettling moments where you realize that everyone you love is currently deteriorating in real time? I'm guessing you probably have, but it's rare because most of us are just way too preoccupied with memes on our phone while working a job that we don't really like. That's probably going to be obsolete soon. Nonetheless, it's happening. Every person that you ever meet is a ticking clock. Now, it's nothing dramatic. It's just this muted, steady leak in the background that we all know is happening. Sort of like a phone battery draining in your pocket while you're standing in line for a $9 coffee or something. And we all signed this unspoken contract to never mention it, or at least to acknowledge it as little as we possibly can. It's basically the ultimate polite fiction where we treat the end of our lives like a spoiler for a film that we're all starring in, which is really kind of bizarre when you think about the statistics. Because death is the undefeated champion. It's got a perfect record. It's liquidated every emperor, every hermit, every plutocrat billionaire who thinks he can negotiate with his DNA by consuming a daily pile of fancy supplements and sleeping in a hyperbaric chamber. Death doesn't care about your biohacking. It's the ultimate debt collector, and it never settles for pennies on the dollar. And yet, here we are, carrying around these retirement projections like they're a map of a place that actually exists somewhere. This is a level of optimism that's frankly pathological. But I get it. This is just the reality of the human condition. We are kind of like a group of people in a room that's rapidly filling with water, but we're staying very focused on who's winning the argument about the thermostat. And we need this grand delusion because waking up from it and facing life without it is terrifying. So we treat our mortality like that one unhinged relative that nobody wants to invite to Thanksgiving. You know the one. He's probably sitting in a parked car down the street, but we just agree to not look out the window. So instead, we do what humans do best. We distract ourselves. And obviously, we're more distracted now than ever because of technology. But the weird part isn't actually about dying. That's just biology doing its chores. The weird part is that we're the only creatures on this planet cursed with the knowledge that it's coming. Well, for instance, a raccoon doesn't spend its twilight years wondering if its trash can raids left a lasting legacy. But you, on the other hand, well, you're different. Because at some point, probably when you were too young to handle it, your brain introduced two ideas that probably should have never met. One, I am here. And two, I won't be. And once those two thoughts shake hands, that's when the free trial of consciousness is pretty much over. So now, that means you're a subscriber to a service that you can't cancel, and the monthly fee is a low-grade sense of dread that never quite leaves the room. It's sort of like the hum from a refrigerator that you only notice when the power goes out. So most of what we call adulthood is really just an elaborate game of hide and seek with that hum. So we pick an identity. We chase status and materialism. We, we build these towering narratives about our so-called purpose. And it isn't because the universe asked us to. It's because it just distracts us from that dreaded hum. And if you sit still for too long, if you actually turn off the podcast and the notifications, the thought eventually is going to find you. It'll creep up and it'll tap you on the shoulder and remind you that your calendar is just an exercise in creative writing. You can't negotiate with it. So you try to outrun it. We tell ourselves stories to feel important enough to stay on the planet. And we say stuff like, I'm building something. I'm leaving a mark. And it sounds noble in a graduation speech, but underneath the hood is just raw anxiety. If your worth depends on being remembered, being ignored is probably going to feel like a dress rehearsal for the grave. You're going to feel that. If you're only as good as your last productive hour, then sitting on a porch is like, it's a dangerous act of rebellion. And suddenly, you aren't actually living a life. Instead, you're just performing a role for some audience that's too busy rehearsing their own lines to even notice yours. I mean, nobody's really paying attention. It's embarrassing to admit, but a huge chunk of our ambition, it isn't fueled by passion or joy the way we like to think it is. It's more truthfully psychological survival. We want to believe that if we attach ourselves to the right ideology, the right movement, or tax bracket, we might become a little less transparent. And we convince ourselves that we're part of something permanent, so we don't have to look at how insignificant we are in the rearview mirror. I don't think this makes us weak. I think it just makes us human. We're just clever enough to see the cliff, but we're not quite evolved enough to enjoy the view. And we never will be. But it does leave us with a pretty awkward and difficult question, which is, how much of your daily life is actually something you want to do? And how much of it is just a shield to keep you from looking at the exit sign? How much of it is being lived from a foundation of fear? And once you start pulling on that thread, the whole sweater starts to unravel. And at that point, you're just standing there, shirtless, facing the cold, hard reality that somehow you have to accept and adapt to. Okay, so there was a guy named Ernest Becker who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book back in the 70s called The Denial of Death. Now, he probably wasn't exactly a barrel of laughs at a cocktail party, but he hit on something so painfully true that it sits there with the quiet, predatory patience of an unexploded bomb. So he argued that the fundamental problem with being a human, you know, the glitch in the matrix of our species, is that we are gods with anuses. It's a bit blunt, but stick with me. So, on the one hand, you've got this symbolic self, this you that's listening to this right now. Your ego, your imagination, your soul, your personal brand, or whatever you want to call it, this part of you may as well be infinite. You can contemplate things like the Big Bang and maybe write poetry that makes strangers cry. You can imagine a world 1,000 years from now. So in your mind, you're like a god. You are the protagonist of a cosmic epic that's been running for decades. But then there's this other side, the meat suit. This is the physical body that gets sunburned and, you know, grows weird moles and eventually inevitably gives out. So you have the mind of a deity trapped in a biological machine that's basically a sophisticated tube for processing food and producing waste. So you can contemplate the edge of the universe, but you still have to deal with a hemorrhoid. And because of this dichotomy, we have the unique and beautifully tragic human condition. Now, another thing that Becker argued is that civilization didn't start because humans wanted to be organized or efficient. It started because we were all collectively losing our minds due to the human condition. There wasn't some grand meeting in a stone hall where the village elders decided to invent society as some kind of shield against the abyss. It was more like a slow motion multi-general panic attack. And at some point, we came to this realization that if we stayed busy enough building things, we didn't have to spend as much time staring at the dirt that we're eventually going to inhabit, which, you know, is hard to argue against. In fact, you could argue that if it wasn't for this pathological desire for distraction, we might not have built anything. So Becker's whole point was that culture is really just a psychological shock absorber. It's a script that you're handed the second you drop onto the planet, and it tells you why you should bother putting on pants and what you're supposed to care about so the world doesn't just look like a giant indifferent rock spinning through a vacuum. Usually this trick works. You follow the script, you get the gold stars, you feel like a person of substance. However, the trouble starts when you actually start believing the script is real life, which unfortunately most of us do. And once your sense of self gets tangled up in the role that you're playing, any threat to that role feels like an actual death sentence. So Becker called these our immortality projects. So if you've decided your whole deal is being the successful one, then a layoff isn't just a financial hiccup for you. It's like an annihilation. If you've staked your identity on being the smart one, then being proven wrong is going to feel like your skin is melting off. And the stakes get weirdly high, weirdly fast. Because you aren't just defending a job or an opinion. You're defending the only thing standing between you and the realization that you are a temporary arrangement of meat. And we like to call this ambition or having drive, which is really just a nice way of branding a quiet, socially acceptable form of desperation. We chase all these titles and milestones because they look permanent. They look like something that might stay behind after we're gone. Humans have pretty much normalized some pretty bleak things to keep this engine running. I mean, most people are walking around in a state of constant low-grade exhaustion or disassociation. And this is becoming the default. We don't question the structure because we can't handle what the world looks like without it. So this is why people go insanely aggressive when you poke at their worldview. Because you aren't just challenging their politics or their religion or what have you. You're threatening the very thing that keeps their existential anxiety at a manageable volume. When you take away someone's belief system, you don't leave them in a neutral state of mind. You're leaving them in a vacuum. And vacuums have a way of sucking old dark fears back to the surface. The kind that you can't just scroll past on your phone. So their rage isn't so much about being right. It's about staying upright. And unfortunately, modern life has only made this worse by turning your identity into something like a 24/7 maintenance project. You aren't just a human being anymore. You are now a brand. You've got a public-facing interface and a digital archive that never sleeps. It's, you know, a strange, artificial half afterlife. It's not immortality. It's just, it's more like prolonged visibility. We are expected to be consistent and legible forever. So we cling to these roles and we perform them louder and louder, arguing, as if our lives depend on it. Because in a very literal psychological sense, they do. The irony of all this is the more energy that we spend trying to deny our end, the less energy we actually have to feel alive. And so we're overstimulated and under present. And even though we're in this state of, I don't know, constant motion, we aren't actually going anywhere. So, as Becker pointed out, this isn't really a personal failing on your part. The system was never designed to help you sit with this reality. It was designed to keep you moving so you don't notice the floor is missing. Even when the system works, when you've bought into the script, when you've kept busy and performed your identity flawlessly, something still manages to slip through the cracks. And it's subtle at first. Maybe it's just a twitch of anxiety with no apparent cause. Or it's like a nagging sense that the world feels slightly off somehow. And you can push it aside and you can blame the weather or social media or a weird dream or whatever. But it's still there. And this is what happens when you deny death so effectively. It doesn't disappear. It just retreats for the time being. And it lives underground. And in the quiet spaces between notifications and the lulls between various tasks. And it lives in that small moment when you're staring at a ceiling and you realize that the room isn't holding anything up. It's all just kind of spinning. And once it's underground, it finds new ways to make itself known. And you become compulsive. You check things obsessively. You argue over opinions like your life depends on it. You overachieve because stopping feels a little too close to staring at the abyss. And you might call this productivity or ambition, but in reality, it's just another form of armor. Burnout is probably the most obvious leak. It's not just being tired or overworked. Burnout is the collapse of the story that you've been telling yourself. This is the story that says, if I just keep moving and looking to the future, then all of this is going to make sense someday. And when the story collapses, well, then the system doesn't stop working. It just leaves you naked in its machinery. And you assume it's your fault. You think, well, I must be lazy. I'm weak. I'm missing the memo on life, etc. But meanwhile, everyone else is doing pretty much the same thing, just in their own way. Then there's the modern twist. So the internet didn't just completely overwhelm us with information. It also gave us permanent visibility. Which means that every opinion or identity, every past mistake, that you showed online in some way, it all lingers in this digital half afterlife. And in this version of reality, you're expected to be legible and coherent and perform yourself like a serialized show that never ends. And any missteps that might occur, they're going to feel catastrophic because someone somewhere can archive that stuff forever. This is why outrage spreads so quickly now. It isn't really about right or wrong. It's really about fear in disguise. It's fear that if you let go even just a little, the scaffolding holding you up will just disappear. So naturally, people grab whatever's in the closet, opinions, moral certainty, and tighten their grip. They argue louder than they need to. They perform their beliefs and they never admit to any doubt, because doubt feels like collapse. Even attention itself becomes a kind of illusion. Because we're endlessly scrolling, endlessly consuming and reacting. And not because anything is actually fulfilling, but because if we stop, that would force us to notice the quiet, unrelenting truth that life is temporary and it's incredibly messy. It's full of chaos and terrifyingly indifferent. The trick isn't to ignore reality. It's to make sure reality doesn't notice you noticing it. So we outsource meaning, and we tell ourselves stories about work and love, achievement, or legacy. And we measure ourselves against performance metrics that really don't matter. So we stay busy because motion feels safer than presence. And in the rare moments when you do actually stop, the abyss, it isn't exactly polite. It doesn't knock. It's already there sipping your coffee and judging your output. Now, the irony, of course, is thick enough to cut with a butter knife. The harder we work to deny death, the less alive we feel. We're connected to everyone now, and yet nothing at the same time. We are overstimulated, but we're starved for actual presence and striving toward immortality through reputation, through a curated identity, all while forgetting that the only thing that's guaranteed is decay. All right, so here's the part where we ask, what are we supposed to do with this knowledge? The quiet truth that the floor has always been missing. And look, I'm not here because I have the answers. I'm here to offer perspective and raise better questions. And, maybe offer a few things that have helped me deal with some of these issues. So first, I would suggest stop pretending that the abyss isn't there. And you don't have to do this in some dramatic life coaching kind of way. Just acknowledge that it exists and let it sit in the corner while you go about your life. Maybe give it a name. I don't know. Call it Frank. Wave at it politely. If nothing more, maybe it's enough to make the rest of the performance feel slightly less urgent. Now, conversely, I wouldn't be in a hurry to meet the abyss either. All of this is going to be over before you know it. So what's the rush? And this is what I mean by perspective. Personally, it's given me, definitely given me a greater appreciation for the present moment. Because that's, you know, the present moment is where everything happens. So, you know, if we do have to live with distractions, try to choose them wisely. Because it seems that most of us are just distracting ourselves by endlessly scrolling social media or obsessing over various things that are harming ourselves and each other. I mean, I would try to choose things that actually keep you present in the world without pretending that it's permanent. You know, maybe it's cooking something for somebody or walking somewhere quiet in nature. Reading a book that you'll probably forget the details of. Talking to someone without checking your phone every 2 minutes. And yeah, these are, look, they're small gestures, but they're gestures in a universe with no guarantees. You know, and that can feel like a rebellion of sorts. Maybe try to lower the stakes on yourself. Ambition is okay, but you know, try not to confuse it with immortality. You don't need to leave some legacy etched in stone or something to matter. You just need to show up imperfectly for however long you get to do that. And if you have goals, maybe don't put all this crushing pressure on yourself to accomplish them. It might be a good idea to have a psychological contingency plan that allows for you to not be devastated if things don't work out. And try to allow your identity to be messy and your mistakes be, I don't know, unremarkable. Because when the world doesn't grant permanence, you get to stop taking yourself so seriously. And yeah, humor usually helps too. Especially if you have a bent for gallows humor, though I realize that's not for everyone. I mean, here's where you get to just laugh at the absurdity of your own seriousness. And, you know, laugh at the ridiculousness of trying to outwit the one thing that outwits everybody. Personally, I don't think laughing is denial. It's just a method of looking at the abyss without collapsing into it. And, you know, one last thing I would do is just try to notice what's happening around you. Not what you're supposed to be achieving. So put the phone and the expectations down for a few minutes and really look at what's around you Let your eyes actually, focus on something besides pixels on a screen. I don't know. Maybe just listen to someone tell a story badly, but passionately. I don't think life needs to be some monumental experience to be meaningful. Sometimes it's just enough to exist. I know it's not easy. It's certainly not permanent, but it works, at least sometimes. And you're not suddenly going to feel immortal or even calm. You might still wake up at 3 a.m. and realize, everyone you love is moving closer to the end while you're just laying in bed, slightly panicked. And that's fine. It's supposed to feel that way. And what changes is that you stop pretending that it isn't happening. And you get a sense of relief about acceptance and letting go. You get to stop bearing the burden of denial. You stop building entire lives as insurance policies against mortality. And you also stop constantly performing. And in that small gap where you're just present for, just a moment, maybe you notice something unexpected. Life actually feels a little sharper, a little stranger maybe, funnier, darker, yes, but ultimately it feels more real and honest. So this is where Becker's point becomes clear. The only way to live fully is to stop trying to outrun the inevitable. It's radical acceptance. The rest is just noise. And suddenly the noise becomes optional. So maybe, we're all just temporary arrangements of stardust meat, spinning through space on a rock that doesn't care. There's no grand cheat code here. There's no final proof. I wish there was, but there's no ultimate trick to stop the clock. And yet, I think there's a way to live that doesn't feel like some frantic, low-key, panicked performance. It's a little terrifying, but it's also, it's liberating. And maybe that's enough. All right. That's all I've got. As always, thanks for listening.